Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week we sit down with Walter Mosley and discuss his work and the craft of writing. This program took place October 24th, 2018, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. At the time, Mosley's novel John Woman had just been published. Mosley's latest, Easy Rawlins mystery, comes out tomorrow, February 2nd. Quick programming note, this discussion contains explicit language and references to sex, drugs, and alcohol. Listener discretion is advised. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, how are we doing tonight? Welcome. Thanks for coming to the American Writers Museum. So I'm just going to make a quick introduction. Part of our mission at the American Writers Museum is to explore the influence writers have on our culture. And tonight we're joined by one of the most versatile and admired writers in the country, the author of more than 40 books whose work has been translated into 23 languages worldwide. Walter Mosley's work has won an O. Henry Award, a Grammy, and Pen America's Lifetime Achievement Award. Writing in Lit Hub, Walter Mosley offered this profound observation on our current cultural moment. I identify with the belief that there exists a history out there just beyond the reach of our powers of cognition, and I believe that a lie is a lie. That if you coexist with a population that helped to build your house, your culture, your music, a population that helped to raise your children and fine-tune your language, and you deny that culture's impact on who you are, then your knowledge of history will fail you and the past will devour you and your children. If you deny your past, your future will be a detour around your fondest hopes and dreams. So that is the power of Mr. Mosley's writing, and that is why he is here tonight. And so he recently wrote a novel about a deconstructionist historian, John Woman, which was long listed for the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. And reviewers called it taut, riveting, and artfully edgy. He'll be joined tonight to talk about the book by the American Writers Museum Program Committee Chair, Mr. Ivan Kane. So please welcome Walter Mosley.
So, Walter, I understand you worked for more than 15 years on John Woman.
I think it was 20 years. And yeah, I started writing. You know, it's I don't know. You know, America is dominated by capitalism. It's an interesting thing, you know, because people know it, but you don't feel it. Capitalism is based on production, and production is based on the production line. And the production line is like putting the left front tire on the Pinto, right? You put the left front tire on the Pinto. That's what you do. And so you don't come in one day and say, well, today I think I'm going to put in the air conditioning. They go, no. You got to get a whole new education and a whole new classification in order to be able to put in air conditioning. You put in the left front tire. Now, my left front tire is a mystery. So I write mysteries, you know. I mean, I've written 57 books, published 57 books, and only 27 of them are crime books. But people still seem to think that the only thing I can write is a mystery. And so I had to work really hard on trying to finish a book that I knew would work on a literary thing. Because what I did was, you know, I was in a PhD program in political theory, which is basically philosophy. And it turns out to be basically the philosophy of history. But nobody knew that and nobody believed it. And, you know, so even once I'd written the book, even after the 20 years were over and I wrote the book, I figured out what the ending should be. 17 publishers refused to publish my book. One guy said, too intellectual. That was it. Didn't even put a period at the end. Just said, too intellectual. One woman said, well, if you would like to come in, I could explain to you how you could make a novel work. And I was like, damn, you know. Anyway, go on. I kind of answered your question.
Well, what changed then over the 15 or 20 years you worked on it?
What do you mean, what changed?
Well, you mentioned you figured out an ending.
I figured out the ending. That's the only thing that changed. I figured out the ending. I said, oh, I see. You know, it has to end in a way that the reader has to decide what happened. Like you, because that's the thing about deconstructionist history. My character is what I call a deconstructionist historian. Because you can never know what happened in the past. Everything you know about the past happens in the future. Think the past changes as the days go on. And so my deconstructionist historian is a guy who says, no, we don't know what happened. We can only gesture toward that. Mm-hmm. And it's a thing that makes everybody dislike him.
You mentioned you were rejected then for this novel. What had you submitted it years ago?
No. Only after I finished. When I found the ending, I started sending it out. And they kept saying, no. Mm-mm. And really, honestly, they could make the money back. My publisher made the money back on this book by selling it to audiobooks. They made the exact same sum that they gave me from audiobooks. And I'm like, so anybody could have done that, you know?
Okay.
It's like, it wouldn't have cost you no money.
Yeah. Okay. Deconstructionist historian. I had some trouble with that. I had trouble making it out. You're at one point, the character creates history from a garbage pail.
Yeah.
And tell us about that.
Well, you know, any real historian will tell you the best way to understand history is by a shopping list. Because if somebody's buying something, they really need it. They're not like going out to buy something for nothing. So I need, 3 pounds of flour, 2 bananas, whatever the thing is that they need. You can pretty much follow what they're bringing in to what they're doing. You know, like an architect could have a shopping list. A housewife can have a shopping list. Guys going out hunting for the weekend, they're going to have a shopping list, you know. And so it's real tangible things. And so, like, what John decides, if I look at this trash can once a week for the next couple of months, I'm going to have a really good idea of the structure of this town and of the people of this town and what they're doing and what they're discarding and what they're keeping and what they're losing. And so that was a thing for him and for them. But, you know, the idea of deconstructionist history is the problem is people think they know what happened. They think they know. They don't, but they think they know. So, for instance, I'll start off by this. Just for me to say, it's one of the things I say all the time nowadays. I don't believe in the existence of white people, you know, the notion of white people. I've never even seen a white person, you know, just to begin with. Nor have I really seen a black person. Never seen a yellow person. You know, there's some people you could probably call them brown. You know, brown people. Most of us are kind of like brown people. But the idea is that if there's a group of people who call themselves white people for no other reason than they want a foot up in the world, and because otherwise you'd say I'm Irish or German or something like that, you know, it's like, you know, you'd have a cultural identity, not a color identity. But the idea of that is so influenced what we call history that you have written history that leaves out all of the Chinese, all of the natives, all of the natives in Spanish, all of the African Americans, certainly leaves all those people out. But those people are part of the history. So if you say your history is something that has nothing to do with the people who actually built your fucking country, then what happens is that you strangle your own potential to know your history. And so the truth is gone, which is what we feel in America today. Nobody even believes in truth anymore because they've been strangled.
On your website, you include an essay that you're tired of history being written by the winners. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, that's the thing. The big thing is you win the war and you write the history.
Right.
You vilify the losers. Richard III is a great example of that. You know, the winners are always going to write history. Let's be clear. Like, so the historian's job is to deconstruct what the winner wrote. That's the job. Okay. I mean, to talk about deconstruction. Yeah. Oh, yeah, he says that they were all good and these people are all bad. But, and then you look at, you know, this and you look at that and you look at this and you try to figure it out. You never figure it out, but you get as close as you can.
Okay. Now, the protagonist, person who becomes to be known is John Woman. He's influenced by his father. His father is described as an autodidact, a self-taught man. Mm-hmm. Is that based in part on your own father?
Nope.
Okay. You have a lot of autodidacts through your literature.
Yeah, you know, I love Herman Melville. He's an autodidact. You know, he just, you know, he was reading Shakespeare while he was writing Moby Dick, and you can really follow it right through. Like, you go, oh my God, oh, this is, he must have been reading Macbeth right here. And here he is reading Lear. You know, it's a kind of a wonderful thing. But also, and if you're not self-trained, you've been brainwashed. If you go to school, they just teach you shit in school. You know, I mean, it's like they teach you. Well, listen, you know, like I mean, there's a logic. You go to school. Most people are working class people. I know Americans say they're middle class, but that's full of shit. And there's no middle class. There's about 8% of America's middle class. The rest of the people are working class people. So they have kids. The kids are smart. The kids want to go to school. They tell them, well, never take a class where you're going to get less than a B. Never take a chance in anything that you ever do. Never always obey the rules and, you know, and always get those A's, always move forward. And you follow these kids moving forward. Now, they don't finish school till they're like 27. But they've been taught from the age of nothing to the age of 27 never to take a chance. So that means that they are not creative people.
So you're an advocate for autodidacts.
I just want to say that if you go to school, school is there to brainwash you, and that might be, you know, you might make more money, you might do better, but you won't know the truth, and you won't know that you don't know the truth.
Now, in the book, John Woolman seems to me to be a follower of what I'll call the classic humanities, we'll say dead white people, Freud, Marx,
Doc Men. I got Doc Men in there. There are black people in it, you know. But yeah. Yes, yeah,
yeah. I've seen in some of your other works some characters, some autodidacts, some have formal training, but. They often also refer to what I'll call the classic humanities. Now, the classic humanities are under fire in a lot of places these days. Where do you come out on that?
Well, and at first, I would ask you, say, what would they read if they weren't reading these books? Like, because you're saying it as if it's a choice.
You know, today most people don't read.
People don't read. That doesn't matter. What's available? And you know, listen. A lot of my books that you're talking about, I'm talking about Easy Rawls, 1940s, 1950s, 1960s. Not today. It's then. You know, Leonid McGill was trained in revolutionary literature, for instance. So it's not wasn't classic. Right. Easy Rawlins, and then when you went to the library, finding people like Doc Benn, for instance. Impossible. So much of the work by so many of the people, you know, you might find Phyllis Wheatley, you know, I mean, honestly, you probably find Zora Neale Hurston. And of course, my characters read those people. Mm-hmm. But what's available to you becomes what's important. And who makes it available to you? The thing is these characters all find it on their own. They just start reading books. They pick up books. They say, oh, this looks like a good book, you know, and they're reading the book. Now, of course, you know, what's his name? Howard Zinn. You know, Howard Zinn, you know, does a wonderful alternative history of America, you know, in which he talks about all those people that are left out of history. I think that's really important. It's really important to let people know that there are other notions of history. So I agree with that. But, you know, I mean, listen, you can read, Walden Pond. That's a great book. You know, it's a great book. And he's a free thinker, you mm-hmm. know. And then you can read, what's his name? Whitman. You know, Whitman. You know, like, but that's the thing. You can read Whitman, but you can't talk about him being gay. You know, that becomes, so like there's, you know, if you open up Whitman wide enough, he's going to teach you everything you need to know. Usually it's kind of closed.
I contain multitudes, as Walt said.
Yes.
Your main character, again, named John Woman, but there's a transformation. John Woman begins as a young boy named Cornelius Jones, who goes by CC. He briefly adopts another name, I think, as he's entering college, and eventually self-adopts the name John Woman. Mm-hmm. The name's kind of provocative. Can you give us the background of why the main character here is called John Woman?
No, I'm not going to do that, but...
But...
I'll say... Well, listen, you got to read the book, right? I mean... But the thing is that it is a really good example of what deconstructionism is, how he takes different pieces and puts them together in a new way, and it all works, including the kind of sexuality in the name. Even that's a part of it, and so I resist explaining, you know, parts of my books because, you know, I mean, you know, yeah, he calls himself John Woman, right? When you figure it out, you go, oh, really? Okay. It'll make sense. It won't be confusing. I promise. Yes.
Well, I agree. I'll ask you one more interpretation question, and you'll probably decline it. And I also want to be careful because, the ending is a little mysterious, and we don't want to give it away. So I'll be careful here. The number three seems to appear at key moments.
Hmm.
You know.
I'm thinking it does. Like where?
Well, okay, the beginning of the book, he kills the character with three blows, with a third blow.
Oh, yeah, that three, yeah.
That three. And three again appears a couple times near the end of the novel.
Yeah.
So, without revealing, is that something we should look at as a hint?
John Woman thinks of himself as a very kind of intelligent person who lives in a real world that can be understood. It's just that humans aren't smart enough to understand it. But he's also extremely superstitious because of his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that three comes out there. The three comes out where he can see the steps toward his own demolition. But also he kind of realizes that he's a sociopath. And that's a very important subject to me in almost everything I write because, you know, really, the successful people in our world are sociopaths. You got to admit it. You know what I mean? You don't want to admit it. You know, like you want to say, no, the good person who lives at the end of the block who always gives, you know, lollipops to children and grandmothers. You know, but no, it's the sociopath who makes it, especially in the system of capitalism, because capitalism, you know, supports sociopathy. You know, that, you know, if the more you're willing to kill, you know, old people and widows out of apartment buildings, the more money you're going to make. You know, the more you raise the rent on people as fast as you can, the more money you're going to make. You know, the cheaper, you know, I guess in World War II, I mean, in Civil War, a guy was making boots for the Northern Army and they were marching and the boots fell apart after one day. And they came back to him and said, you know, what the hell is wrong? We want our money back. He said, well, you don't understand. I made those boots for the cavalry. They're supposed to be on a horse. They're not supposed to be walking. You know, I just, you know, and it's just like, say anything, right? You know, so I think that the three is his superstition. And it may have some basis in reality.
Okay. You're describing the classic sociopath as the real estate developer.
And I'm sorry, I know because you worked in
digital. I'm going somewhere else. It sounds like our president.
No, it does sound like our president, you know, and, you know, he wasn't actually the worst choice we had. You know, we have a country in which You know, our last president was an anomaly. You know, and now we have, you know, a guy, you know, who like, you know, who, because people have lost faith in truth, they don't care that he's lying to them, because there's a sense of either I'm going to get what I deserve, or at least I give me some revenge. You know, and I think that that's what's happening, you know. And of course, on the other side, there are people who don't understand that there are other people who need help, who might be on the other side from you politically or whatever. I mean, it's a very interesting thing. Yeah.
I'm going to turn to just a couple questions about your body of work. You're famous for your mystery series, E.Z. Rollins, Leonard McGill, Socrates Fortlow, Fearless Jones, others. You recently, one of your recent books featured Joe King Oliver, an ex-cop. Will we see more of him?
I don't know, actually. I don't know. Because I don't really think it out. I mean, somebody could come, listen, if somebody came up tomorrow and said, you know, I'll give you $100,000, write this next book, I'll do it. You know. You know, I mean, you know, it's like, sure, why not? You know, and I might write one anyway, if I feel the urge, you know, to write it. I've been trying to do a television show on it, but, you know, it's very hard working with Hollywood. You know, they have things, you know. We went to a meeting, and I have a partner, Diane, who's like a Chinese, black Jamaican woman. And there's these three guys, all of whom think they're white. And they're all 5'4", and they're all wearing the same suit, slightly different color. And they're all sitting there looking at us, you know, making decisions. What's the funniest thing? They're saying, well, you know, because, you know, the fun thing about the book is the daughter. Because the daughter is, she is the thing that has maintained her father's sanity. But the daughter is not Veronica Mars. You know what I mean? But like these people are saying, well, maybe we could make a Veronica Mars. And I'm like looking at him going, you know, listen, you give me enough money, you can. I don't care. But that's not what I want to do. And we tried to put a thing together, but it doesn't make sense. It would be okay to take the daughter and leave him out of it. But if he's going to still be there, it doesn't make sense. And it didn't. And so, you know, we went to pitch it a couple places, and they said no. Now we're going to pitch it some more places, and hopefully I have more to do with it this time.
Devil with a Blue Dress was written by someone else. The book was written by you, but the movie written by someone else. But then at least one other of your books was filmed. You wrote the screenplay.
Oh, it's outnumbered. You know,
that's right. That's right.
Cicely Tyson.
Now, would you want to control the writing of the screenplay, or would you give away a property?
Well, it depends. You know, like if somebody came up to me with a great idea and they could write the screenplay and they had all this talent, I don't mind them writing it. That doesn't bother me. My control, you know, control in Hollywood has to do is if you produce or not, because only producers make money. If you start looking up people on the, you know, like in Wikipedia, and they tell you how much they're worth, you know, if they're worth enough, and you start comparing actors to producers, producers always have more money. So, well, Bruce Willis got $400 million. But the guy who produces his movies, he got $900 million. You know, it's like, wow, what happened? You know, so I like to be in control of the money, you know.
Okay.
And I would like the script to be good.
So is there any chance we'll see another E.Z. Rollins book?
I mean, I'm writing one right now called Blood Grove.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fun.
Good. A couple of general questions. I'll put these together. Who do you read, and who influenced you?
Well, you know, I'll answer the influence question. You know, I mean, you know, like I read everybody, but and everything. You know, influence is a great thing. Like, if you guys like decide to start coming here more often or something, because I heard him say shame on you. If you decide to come here more often, or you go somewhere else, and there are writers sitting in front of you, and you should ask and say, who influences you? Now, I want you to understand this person, every person except myself, is going to lie to you. Every single one of them. Young black woman sitting in front of you, she's just written a book about her life in Mississippi or something. And they said, well, who influenced you? And she'll say, first, Phyllis Wheatley, because probably you don't know who she is. And then Zora Neale Hurston, because probably you do. And then Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, Edwige Nantucket, Entezake Shange, Sonia Sanchez, June Jordan. I mean, it's going to go on and on and on. All these extraordinary writers. But she's not telling you them because they influence her. She's telling you them because she wants you to compare her work to their work. Because who really influenced her what's her name? The mystery girl. Nancy Drew. Who really influenced her is Nancy Drew. Right? She's a little black girl living across the street, you know, in the house this little girl always wanted to live in. And that's who influenced her. Because we're not in, and listen, if you gave your 8-year-old daughter Beloved, she'd come back to you and say, Mama, one of us got to die. Because, you know, this is too serious. You know, a little girl can't be reading. But your closest relationship to writing, to belief in writing. When you're a kid reading, it almost doesn't even happen. It's like that world, you're seeing it, you know, play out in front of you by reading. That's how powerful, like, an early reader is. And those influences for me, like it was, Jack Kirby drawing the Fantastic Four and Captain America, you know? It was my father who could make anybody mad and laugh at the same time by telling a story. And my father, by saying to me, Walter, tell me a story. It's about those black male heroes that I was surrounded by, who took care of me, who protected me, who educated me when I was a child. That's the influence. You know, the influence is never writing. People come up to me and say, well, writing make readers. I'm saying, well, everybody reads. How come everybody ain't a writer? You know, it's like. There's a notion. I mean, reading is a wonderful thing, and it's an important thing, but it doesn't necessarily make writers. You know, reading is, you know, I mean, because a writer has a story to tell. You know, you're raised in hip hop Chicago, you got a story to tell that's never been written before. People, like, it'd be hard even to find the influence. You know, but you're going to write that story if you feel it.
You know what? Let's open it up to the audience.
Okie doke.
Hi, sorry to interrupt. At this point, we opened up the discussion to the audience. However, their questions were inaudible, so we will introduce each question before Mr. Mosley gives his response. This first question came from a professor who asked how he can inspire more men of color to pursue further education.
Now, to begin with, of course, I'm not believing that I have the answer to that question. You know what I mean? It's like, that's a big question. And, you know, it's like, but I'm going to use an example of one thing. And I believe that this one thing is the first building block on all the rest of the things to do. I'm going to start, you know, I feel so silly at my age saying this, but my best friend is a guy named Paul Coates. Paul Coates, in the 60s, was the head of the Black Panthers of Baltimore. Later on, he started a press to publish books to send into prisons. Now he has a big black classic press, been going on for 40 years. He gives all these books out, you know, all over the world, books by and about people of color. And his son, it happens to be Ta-Nehisi Coates. So, like, it's like, everybody knows Ta-Nehisi nowadays. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's spelled Ta-Nehisi, but it's pronounced Ta-Nehisi. And you know, all of Paul's children are upstanding members of the community. I mean, you know, Ta-Nehisi is like a whole step beyond that. But all of them are. But people will come up to me for years and they'll say, Mr. Mosley, how do I get my child to read? And I look at them and I say, well, do you read? And they say, well, I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about my kid. I say, yeah, I am too. Do you read? I say, you know, if you drink whiskey, drink cigarettes, and beat your wife, that's what your kid's going to do, right? And if you sit down every day and you're reading a book and your little kid's looking at you reading that book, there's a good chance. It's not necessary. But, you know, but I think that's where it's based, It's based in what we give to our children and what we teach them by who we are. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you end up like Tupac Shakur, who also comes out of the Panther movement, you know. But I think, but even that's not a bad thing, you know. It's just like, it just scares, you know, so-called white people. But I think that the real image starts to begin. It's like, how do we become the role models for the children who know us? Not children we don't know, but like children who know us. People say, oh, Uncle Dan. Hi, Uncle Dan. Say, hey, what you doing? Say, well, I'm reading this comic book here. You want to come read it with me? And they say, yeah, I'll read it. Say, well, what do you think about that? Well, you know, and then just that discussion is going to change that kid's life so deeply, you know?
This next question was asked by a middle school librarian who wondered if Mr. Mosley would ever write for the middle grade reading level.
47 is a young adult book.
So wait.
She just handed him the book.
We made a connection here. This is great.
There's a bookstore in Los Angeles called Esawen. They know me, call them. There are hundreds of those books that are being published by black people all over the country. They don't make it to you. I know that. But they're there. They're out there. People are publishing. They're trying to distribute them. It's a difficult thing. The books are there. Talk to Third World Press, Haki Madhubuti here. Haki will give you lists and lists and lists of books that you could that you can have. You know, it's a very difficult, it's a difficult thing, but the books are there. And it's just like mine. I only wrote one, but 47 is a good book, you know.
This next response is on the topic of getting young people to read, which is sometimes difficult.
Also, I think that it's really true. Like, for instance, the Socrates Fort Lowe stories, you know, always outnumbered, always outgunned. Those kind of stories. Inner city kids, regardless of race, love them. You give a kid Easy Rollins, and he could work with that. He could say, damn, all right. You know, you give an inner city kid Catcher in the Rye, and they just don't get it. They say, I don't understand what's wrong with him. He rich. He got a car, man. He could do anything. What he complaining about? You know, and it's like, you know, but if you read, you know, it's outnumbered when, you know, Socrates finds the kid who's killed a chicken and he realizes he's actually killed a person at some point, you know, then, yeah, they see that. They say, God, there's no way out for him. But Socrates sees a way out. And that becomes the thing. Now, of course, these are books kids can read. I mean, you know, really, honestly, they could read them. A lot of people don't want to give them to kids because they say, well, you know, there's some sex in there. I said, well, you know, your kids are probably having more sex than you are, you know. So maybe, you know.
Next question.
Here, someone asked Mr. Mosley, which is harder work, writing fiction or nonfiction?
I don't feel it's hard work. I mean, this is a thing. And this a woman once asked me, she said, how do you, you know, you find the, you know, the concentration to work so hard to write your books? I said, like, how do I find the concentration to have sex? I mean, it's, in a way, this concentration, in a way, you know, it's hard, you know, but no pun there. But but it's a thing I love to do.
So let me say, Frank.
Okay.
So writing is fun.
Okay.
Which do you have more fun at, fiction or nonfiction?
You know, this is another interesting question. The other day, because, you know, I wrote this year, You Write Your Novel. It's a book that the simplistically, start today, 365 days later, a novel will be finished. I can't promise you what's going to happen in that novel, but you can write it. The other day, I was in between books, and I thought, you know, one of the terms in that book is the structure of revelation. Talking about plot, I said, plot is the structure of revelation, when you reveal pertinent information throughout the novel. And I thought about that term. I said, you know, that's a very good term. I'm going to write another book that does a much deeper dive into writing fiction called The Elements of Fiction. And it was so much fun writing it. I mean, really, it was so much fun. I had, you know, because I only write 3 hours a day. I actually had to stop myself. I said, no, Walter, you got to stop. It's 3 hours. You got to stop. You know, because it was so much fun to do. And of course, you know, if I'm writing about Easy Rollins or Mouse or I'm, you know, John Woman, even, you know, even though it took me so long, I love that. You know, so I don't feel that it's I don't feel it. There are some people that can only write one kind of thing. That's what they love. That's what they're committed to. They're only committed to science fiction. They're only committed to mystery. They're only committed to historical fiction. Well, okay, then that's what they do. But for me, there's different ways to tell different stories.
By the way, you've written plays, screenplays. You've helped produce a graphic novel. I'll just ask.
Erotica?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So you have no bounds.
I don't. I just recently wrote a story that was in Playboy, which is it's the one genre I hadn't been able to crack that I wanted to. It was a Western.
Hmm.
And it was about it was like maybe 6 months ago, but it was so much fun because I had finally written a Western. It's contemporary and it's New York, but it's definitely a Western.
Okay.
And it was so much fun.
At this point, Mr. Mosley discusses the noir genre, its evolution, and where it is at today.
Well, you know, here's the thing. You know, the noir genre, the hard-boiled and noir and mystery genres, crime novel genres, are actually kind of a genre form of existentialism. It's how a person, man or woman, makes a stand for what's right, regardless of what the law says, regardless of what their safety says, regardless of what the police say, they're going to do what they think is right, even if everybody else thinks it's wrong. The early people, you know, Ross McDonald, Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, Kane, all those people, they wrote about detectives who had no mother, no father, no sister, no brother, no regular house, no car. Like, everything was different. Like if somebody came up and said, "Well, I'm gonna arrest you," they say, "Okay," because there's nothing. They didn't even have a fish that they got to feed. You know what I mean? And you know, and that was wonderful. I mean, these are great writers, and they wrote great books. So I'm not criticizing them. But I think the evolution of it, you know, when it comes up to like, you know, what I'm doing, what some other people are trying to do, it's harder to be committed to your existential reality when you got a child at home, when you got a dog at home, when you have like a friend who's old and sick, you know, when you have things in your life that we all have in our lives and you still have to do the right thing, that becomes much more of a challenge.
Thank you to Walter Mosley and Ivan Kane for that discussion. And thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, in anticipation of Valentine's Day, hear from romance writer Jasmine Guillory, who visited in 2019 to discuss her novel, The Wedding Party. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.